Good evening, people. This is John Johnson on Radio Edutalk. Radio Edutalk is an educational podcast come internet radio show. We broadcast a couple of days a week. And I'm delighted to have, I think I describe him as an old friend of the show. He's been on, he's not old, but he's been on once or twice before. Doug Belshaw. Hi, Doug.
Hi, John. I've got enough grey hair. I think I can describe myself as old these days.
Thanks, Doug. I just missed that because I'm not. I always miss buttons and things. This is you're talking to the professional end of podcasting here. So it's very nice to hear you again. Now I've clicked that button.
Well, I'm here.
Yeah, and maybe I'm guessing an awful lot of people in the UK educational scene, and in fact the worldwide educational scene, will know you. And if we asked you for a brief history of your educational experiences, it would probably take up the whole show, so we could have an even briefer sort of summary of where you've been and what you've done
to
get where you are.
I doubt anyone will have me, but basically I used to be a teacher, then I was a senior leader, then I worked for JISC in higher education, then I worked for Mozilla on badges and web literacy, and I'm now a consultant and I do things still around badges, still around kind of digital web literacy kind of stuff, but also just like new technologies and interesting stuff and noodling around with how educators could use it. And I guess I'm working a lot with City and Guilds at the moment around their vocational qualifications and their business processes and stuff, and just making myself useful, I guess.
And you've got a great line on your website to describe yourself. You say an open educational thinkerer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of playing on the idea of being a tinkerer.
Yeah.
I definitely describe you as a tinkerer, John. Someone who just sometimes plays about with stuff for its own sake. Yeah. Just to see what you can do with it. And, you know, I'm greatly inspired by some of the stuff you've done with DS106, some of the stuff we did together back in the days of EdTech Talk and EdTech Roundup and all that kind of things. It seems like years ago, doesn't it? It's only about 10 years ago.
Yeah, I was thinking, I've actually looking back at some history, and I made the first podcast I made with kids in the class in 2004.
Oh my goodness, ancient history.
And I was listening to it the other day because something came up on Twitter, actually. Somebody was saying, look outside your window and describe it. It was one of these wee sort of challenges. And I remembered, I thought, oh gosh, that's the very first thing I had kids had written stuff for homework. I said, just look out your window for 5 minutes and then describe what you see. And it came back and it was quite good. And I thought, oh, I'll record this. And it is just, I mean, my audio editing and quality is, I don't think, high by any manner of means, but this was incredible. It was recorded in a cupboard with a fan, with, I think, Windows whatever recorder that came in, and I could only figure out how to do a minute at a time, so I was recording minute segments and then stitching them together later. But that was say, 10 years ago, so I guess it's a long time.
To me, you know, the technologies come and go, and it's the kind of, it's the communications, it's the what we do with it, which is the important stuff. And podcasting seems to have had a bit of a resurgence, which I think is good. But then there's so many other things that it's not like we live in the greatest age ever right now in 2015. So, you know, you mentioned Windows and Microsoft. Actually, Microsoft, was it Microsoft Live Writer? That blogging
tool? Yeah, yeah.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
And that was 2006, 7, something like that.
Yeah.
And there's nothing like it now, even. So it's not, just because we, I think I try and tell my kids, like, just because we live in a time where we have the shiniest things, fastest things ever, doesn't mean that we live in the best of times.
But it is quite interesting if you like tinkering and the likes.
It is.
And what we kind of just said before we started this show, that we'll just sort of ramble over some of your interests and bits and pieces. And
not everyone switches off straight away, yeah, right, okay.
Well, we could maybe just touch on quickly that you have got a podcast now.
That came out of EdTech Roundup, which did start about 2007, I guess. Mm. Went for about 3 years. Kind of got resurrected and didn't. That was a meeting on a Sunday night of educators, including yourself, coming together using, I think the Open University had something called Flash Meeting.
Yeah.
And we'd all come together and we'd record it. And the idea was that, yes, it was a podcast you could listen to afterwards, but the main thing was people coming together with somewhat of an agenda. And it was some kind of solidarity and bringing together a very nascent kind of blogging community, etc. And then I went off into higher education and Mozilla and stuff, and that just kind of fell away, and you picked up the baton with some podcasting, and other people did some stuff. And podcasting kind of didn't die, but kind of was on the back burner for lots of people, I think. And then it's had this renaissance, and then I met up with Di Barnes, who was my co-host for a lot of that time on EdTech Roundup. I met up with him just before I became a consultant. He was like, I really miss that time when we did that stuff. I was like, yeah, me too. So we decided that it would be a good opportunity to have a weekly chat about ed tech kind of stuff, digital education. And we just messed about. We ended up with something called Tide, Today in Digital Education. So tidepodcast.org. And we just talk for about an hour on a Sunday night, usually stuff that I put into my newsletter, stuff that Di's come across, things he's been doing at his school. He's head of digital strategy at Oundle, which is a private school. And yeah, just have a, it's mainly for our benefit and other people find value in it.
Well, I mean, the shape of the show seems to be around a series of bookmarks you've shared with each other. And you have a conversation. And I've noticed that you say there's been a resurgence in podcasting of different sorts. Some very high end. I'm thinking of the Serial thing and, other stuff. But there's a lot of kind of tech and conversational podcasts now out there, which I think is quite interesting. And I guess it's more relaxed and long form than podcasts used to be, maybe.
Yeah, and I listen to quite a lot of podcasts as well, and one of the ones I never miss is Tim Ferriss's podcast, just because he interviews such amazing people. So on the I've just been in London, and I've been back on the train, and I was listening to the one with Reid Hoffman, who is he founded PayPal, LinkedIn, all these different companies. He's on the board of Mozilla, and so just such a did philosophy. It's just interesting. Guy, but one of the things that Tim Ferriss was saying, that he explicitly focuses on long form content because it has long term value. People come back to it, people get huge value out of it instead of it just being snack size, bite size stuff, the BuzzFeed of the internet. And I don't think you or I or anyone I know and respect really is interested in really, really short form stuff. We're interested in like trying to tease out the nuances, what's possible with it, bouncing ideas off each other, that kind of stuff.
So I've got a wee bit of a compliment there, so I've lost my thread, Doug. I think there's a podcast revival. It's a sort of high-end thing. I think the conversations come in, and it seems that people are maybe more interested in listening to podcasting, and I certainly hope that as an educational tool, it can have a wee bit of a revival.
Well, you're doing something slightly different here. I mean, we're recording, obviously you have to record things live, and we're recording the podcast on a Sunday night, often while I'm having a whiskey, etc., and Di is having a smoke and reminiscing and all this kind of stuff. And then I chop it up and do a bit of editing and then send it out on a Tuesday, whereas I guess you do a bit of post-processing stuff on this, but effectively right now, as Ian Guest is tweeting, hi Ian, this is going out live and people can listen to it as it goes. And I think, is there a name for that kind of podcasting as opposed to the definitely kind of pre-recorded, a bit of editing kind of stuff?
I'm not sure, but I definitely feel it's a different thing, and I think it would be useful for in education, all sorts of levels. One of the reasons I like it is because it cuts out the temptation to do much post.
You kind of have to keep it real.
Yeah.
Some people have already listened to it. And so if you cut out a big section in the middle, people will be like, hang on a minute, what's going on there? Yeah.
I mean, occasionally somebody will say something, they'll come back and say, well, you know, I really don't want that bit, and I'm quite happy to go and nip it out. But I quite like, when I podcasted with a recording, I would re-record bits and do sentences and all the rest of it, and I think that was just too much bother for the end product. And I think a conversation, especially, you get a kind of natural flow going.
About the kind of spontaneity of it as well, and you're bouncing ideas off and stuff. I do like the format. I like the longer form of stuff, and it's worth putting the time in. I'd much rather read and actually write longer form stuff and put things together and curate newsletters and do podcasts that are long, because sometimes, I mean, I do appreciate, for example, Seth Godin's really short blog posts. The reason they're so useful is because he's obviously spent a lot of time crafting exactly the right words to put together. It's like that Mark Twain quote about, or whoever it is, about, I didn't have enough time to write you a short letter, so I'll write you a long one. You know, like, there's definitely that kind of element, and I do appreciate people who spend time to craft stuff so that it's short enough to be really pithy and worthwhile. But then I really like the long form stuff as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And you touched on your newsletter, which is another useful source of information. And just on that, I wonder, because it is, I guess, almost bullet points with pictures of interesting things. Do you think of that as a whole piece where they go together?
Oh, interesting. So on times when I have... Yeah, I don't know if this is because there's weeks where I spend more time immersed in the stream, as it were, and therefore I have more stuff to pull from. But there does seem to be some weeks where it kind of writes itself, because there's only, you know, 7 to 10 links which I think are worth sharing. And it's loosely around education, technology, and productivity, usually in that order, actually. But sometimes I have this whole wealth of stuff, so I have to pick it, and I try and do it so that it hangs together somehow. And that hanging together might be because the images go together somehow. And it's fairly unconscious, John. It's certainly not a work of art. But the recent, you know, I took the summer off. I took August off blogging and social media and putting together my newsletter. And then I rebranded it. So it was Things We Learned This Week. And I've rebranded it as Doug Balshaw's Thought Shrapnel, because I had a Tumblr blog, which I discontinued. And then Brian Mathers, who I've been working with, hi, Brian, if you're listening, he did this amazing image of a head opening, like me with my cap on, opening, and then just this stuff coming out. And the words thought shrapnel, someone asked me yesterday where that came from. And that came from a guy called Frank Chimero, who's a very well-known designer, wrote a book called The Shape of Design, put it on Kickstarter and stuff a few years ago. And when he was working on that book, he apologized on his blog for not having any content on there recently. And he said, I'm really sorry, all of my thoughts are going into my book at the moment. Everything else is just thought shrapnel. And I thought, oh my goodness, when I read that. And I registered my name immediately. It was such an amazing term.
Yeah.
It's now a sponsored newsletter. Makers Academy are sponsoring it this month. But lots of previous kind of sponsors. It's open for sponsorship in the future. But that's just to make sure that I spend time on it and I don't like skip weeks as I used to do before it was sponsored, or you know, I have to have a reason why it's taking me away from my wife and kids at the weekend, that kind of stuff, because it takes time to put together. It's just it's a way of doing that, I guess.
Okay, and I know that you've talked badges a lot over the last few years. I have seen you talking about badges quite, you know, in different places to different audiences, and you're working on badges at the moment with the City and Guilds, I think, as part of the work. Yep. And I know you don't, you know, I think you've actually maybe we've got, if somebody looks in our archive, they can probably find a whole show on open badges. But is there anything at the moment that's bubbling up or becoming more interesting or easier to get your head around with open badges?
Yeah, so just very quickly on that. The reason I was interested in open badges, John, was, you know, I used to always be suspicious of people calling themselves educator. I was like, oh, you're just a teacher who's not in the classroom and you're not keeping it real anymore and all that kind of stuff. You know, and you and I are both in positions where we have been teachers, former teachers, classroom teachers, and we still consider ourselves to be educators, although we spend a lot of our time in offices and talking to business type of people, etc. Even though you spend a lot of time going into schools and education institutions. So when I was at JISC, it was 2011, and I found out about badges, and I was like, this could actually solve some of the problems that I came across as a teacher, where all of these kids didn't really have a way in which they could show who they were as a holistic person, all their skills and knowledge. Anyway, fast forward a few years, so 4 years, I've been a judge for the DML competition that seed-funded the ecosystem. I've worked for Mozilla on the badges team. I've worked for Mozilla on other stuff. I then left Mozilla working on stuff. And so now we're in a position where most of the grant funding, the initial grant funding in the US for badges, has kind of finished. So it's more business as usual funding. So badges actually doing some work. But in the UK, there's never really been huge amounts of funding for badges. The Nominate Trust did some stuff, and there's been little pots of funding here and there. So all of the growth has been organic, which means that right now is actually coming up to a peak of badge interest. So I've had conversations with the Scottish Qualifications Authority and other bodies in Scotland, obviously City and Guilds, the Welsh Government, the Department of Education, all these different universities, schools, local authorities, loads of people interested in badging. And I guess what the world needs now is a default way of issuing badges and displaying them. So there's the Mozilla backpack, etc. But Digital Me, who you know, John, and I've worked with closely and done some consultancy with and worked with when I was at Mozilla, they've got something called Open Badge Academy coming out in October. And that's going to be, from what I've seen in terms of the screenshots and stuff, it's going to be an amazing place to be able to really easily issue badges. And not only that, but discover ones that like organizations have come up with. So I've seen some examples of one with for apprenticeships and all sorts of things. So I'm hoping that that really stimulates a lot of discussion and debate, and because it's little pockets of innovation, but it's a shame because that's kind of what badges is trying to avoid. It's trying to prevent those silos. IBM are doing some stuff around badges. I think Pearson, like there's loads and loads of lots and lots of activity, and because it's an open standard and ecosystem, it's all interoperable, but it's not really joined up so much on a coordinated basis. And I think that's mainly Mozilla's fault, to be honest. They've kind of pushed badges to be a bit arm's length. They're still looking after the technical infrastructure, but they spun out the Badge Alliance as a non-profit, and then there's been some politics and stuff there. But I think that the ecosystem is broadly healthy, which is a good thing. It's largely self-sustaining. There's still lots of interest. And in terms of the Gartner hype cycle, Now, if you don't know what that is, people listening, just type a quick search on your favorite search engine. You have this peak of inflated expectations where you think it can solve everything ever. You have this trough of disillusionment where you think, oh my goodness, this is useless. And I think we're heading towards what is called the plateau of productivity, where you think, oh, obviously you'd use badges for that because it's the obvious thing to do.
Well, I think there's a couple of wee problems that would solve, and one of them is the one one of the ones that seems in Scotland people are interested in is the sort of move between school and the next step, either employment or, you know, college or something. And there's something in there about evidence that's not an exam for employers that's useful. But I think the real thing is when it's easy to just do it, you know what I mean? When tools become really simple. We're talking about podcasting, and when we started podcasting, you had to create an RSS feed. And how do you do that? Well, lots of typing and reading other RSS feeds and copying them. And, you know, it was complicated and a bit of a pain.
It's such a complicated thing, because actually when you scratch, it looks easy and straightforward. When you scratch beneath the surface, the reason it's so complicated. So yesterday, City and Guilds get loads of people around a table, and we're just having what seems like a simple conversation about badge visual design. But it becomes this mega conversation about brand guidelines, different color schemes, what different shapes mean in different cultures. Oh my goodness me. And that's just trying to get the shape and size and color of the badge and stuff. But what I found, John, is when people think they want a conversation with me about badges, what they don't really want a conversation about badges. They really, it's a Trojan horse for the hopes and dreams and expectations and all that kind of stuff of the organization, because they've never really been able to articulate that. So even teachers who you'd think would be really grounded in pedagogy and learning design and assessment design and all that kind of stuff, they're not, because they often given curricula and they're often given the assessment that they have to provide. So they're, when they're let loose on, hey, you can do anything and different badge pathways and stuff, you know, they're often in the same situation as everyone else. They've got a bit more understanding of pedagogy and how learning scaffolded, but they're often in the same situation of what I can do absolutely anything. Yeah, off you go. And so you have to start giving people models. And Brian Mathers did some stuff today based on some of Gronje Hamilton's work around different types of badge pathways. So you can imagine one being a very prescriptive one where you are trying to cross a river and it's just like a stepping stone kind of approach where you do this, 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 this. Or another one might be, you know, in Trivial Pursuit where you have that round circle, you put all different bits of pie in or cheeses. One where you can do them in any order and they build up together to the meta badge. And then the one which I find most compelling is the constellation approach, where there's all of these badges and you can either choose your own constellation or you can be guided towards this different constellation of badges, or even some kind of stealth assessment where you happen to do this collection of badges and it unlocks something or pops up with a badge or whatever. And I think there's so much opportunity to do stuff that really it's not about the badge, it's about the learning design.
And I guess, again, that leads to a lot of things, like the way the curriculum's been in Scotland is when we got freedom from our old curriculum and moved into Curriculum for Excellence. For a lot of us, it was, oh my goodness, you know, it's a big chunky problem I've got here. I don't have my guidelines to cling on to.
Yeah, and then, you know, even applying badges to an existing system. So you take the curriculum, for example, and you try and apply badges to it. That's hard enough. But then when you're trying to create the curriculum or the standard or whatever that to build on, it's really tough and it takes a long time. And if you're trying to involve multiple stakeholders, it's like that African proverb, you know, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And if you want to go the distance with people, it's going to take time. There's going to be some arguments and falling out. And so that's why at Mozilla, when you're trying to do badges for web literacy and you're trying to do a web literacy standard or web literacy map, and you're trying to do it on a global basis and trying to use words which translate well into Argentinian Spanish, and it just becomes so complex that ending up with something which looks relatively simple, which I hope the web literacy map kind of did when we got to version 1.5, means that it has to hide all of that complexity behind it. And that's such a tough thing to do.
Just on that, I just noticed a couple of weeks ago there was a nice new, because you worked on the web literacy thing, and the Mozilla Thimble, there's a new version out.
Yeah, that's right. So what they did, they've been working on that a while, and what it is, so it's now at thimble.mozilla.org, and the code name for that was Bramble. I don't. Did you see David Humphrey's blog post about the development process behind that?
No, I'm on a list from Mozilla, and I just noticed and clicked and played with it for a while, but I didn't, so I didn't see that.
David Humphrey has got a blog called Bread and Circuits, which I think is hilarious.
Yeah.
And on this blog, he talks about, basically the code name for it was Bramble, when they were developing this when I was still at Mozilla. And so, as you know, John, you can now develop you can have index.html and style.css. Mm. So you can have files which relate to each other. So let me just put the link actually in the Skype chat. There we go. That'd be useful.
Yeah, I was impressed by the editor. I thought it made it a big job. But I'm wondering...
Well, they based it on Adobe Brackets, I believe.
I'll see that. Yeah, it says it's a forked version of Brackets. But the thing I was wondering is, I felt in the last year or so, and all I've done is really had the Mozilla Webmakers email. I think I did a wee bit of a MOOC at some point and just kept on getting email, and it's always interesting. And it impressed me how widespread it was around the world, especially in India and other places. And I wonder how this sort of stuff, how you see it fitting in with the new curriculum in England. I'm talking about the primary and secondary curriculum, where coding has become really important.
It depends who you're talking to, doesn't it? Because if you talk to purists, they say that HTML and CSS is not coding, it's markup.
Hmm.
And so you get purists saying, oh, it's not part of the coding or whatever. What, to my mind, okay, fair enough. And they even talk about JavaScript not really being coding, and I'm like, well, the important thing is about loops and arrays and that kind of thing. So I will be going in and running an ICT club, as I did last year, using Thimble and WebMaker tools and stuff in my kid's school. And in fact, it's to year four, so it'll be my son as well this year. But I think the important thing for me, John, is that not everything has to go like one-to-one with the curriculum. And you're very fortunate in Scotland in that you've got like a kind of a competency-based curriculum. So more things count towards your curriculum than they perhaps do in England.
At least in primary schools and the early secondary is focused on high stakes testing, I think, certainly.
Perhaps I'm out of date, but I think, I don't know, I'm perhaps out of touch and don't know enough about it, to be honest, but to my mind, it's one of those tools. It's free, it's on the web, it's easy to use. It's by an organisation you can trust in terms of security and privacy and that kind of thing. And I think in the same, I don't know if I want to get out into this, but certainly when I was teaching, and I was definitely guilty of this, you'd use, because there was no budget, you'd use anything that was free and engaging, no matter if it was surrounded by, you know, like, questionable advertising at a spammy URL, like all sorts of stuff going on. And I think we need to be a bit wiser about guiding young people around the web a bit more and saying what counts as quality and also being good citizens of the web and showing people showing children that we should be paying for some stuff on the web and sharing as teachers and educators and parents that, hey, this is the stuff that I pay for because I find it valuable. And, you know, when I'm not paying for it, then there's a reason I'm not paying for it, because I'm being advertised at, or data mining, you know, all of my personal information and whatever. I don't want to get too much into that, but I think it's an important thing to teach.
I certainly think that. And I wonder, talking about back in the day, in the middle of the 2000s, all that time ago, I remember being completely convinced by that we were at the start of something where it would end up that every teacher would be blogging or whatever, and have an understanding, because the web's become and was obviously going to become really important to education. And I'm aware more and more of a widening gap, and you know, some of the things that you're blogging or podcasting about, the use of, you know, GitHub or something like that, is just very far away from a lot of classroom teachers' experience, and I wonder how we close that.
Yeah, but that's, you know, let's not be... I don't think you're being disingenuous, John. I'll never accuse you of that. But let's just remind ourselves of what we were trying to do in 2007. We were trying to get large numbers of teachers on Twitter. Mm. And there are now large numbers of teachers on Twitter. I don't use Facebook, but from what I gather, there are a number of popular Facebook groups focused on education and teaching and exchange of ideas, LinkedIn groups, etc. So it's not as if people aren't using online tools. And I think some of it is just down to personality. So if you're not a writer and, you know, you've never been the type of person who even writes stuff down in a diary for yourself, like, perhaps you're just not someone who blogs, like, you know, perhaps that's okay.
I think there's been a huge, because I remember even a few years ago people beating their chests in woe by the fact that, you know, schools tended to block Twitter, and now they basically use it and, you know, use it a lot to publish stuff that's going on in school and all the rest of it. But it's more the understanding of the trade-offs and things that I think are maybe not as well understood. The sort of idea that, you know, who owns what you're putting on there.
Oh, in terms of privacy and security and stuff. Well, you've got to remember, it's hard for us to understand, even as people who are really interested in this kind of thing. Like, I've spent a decent amount of time, I'm not as technical, on the spectrum of being like technical and understanding different programming languages and how the web works and stuff. Like, you are further to the hardcore end than I am, and no one would doubt that. But even, I would say, possibly you and I, if we had to set up a extremely secure communications channel which hadn't got to leak any data, would find that a difficult thing to do, because it's just super difficult to do that kind of stuff on the web. So, and part of that is because it's not tangible. You can't see it. And so I remember having the conversation last week to my wife about HTTPS, and she was like, what do you mean? I was like, well, you know, when you get the padlock. Oh, right, yes, the padlock. And it's like trying to use metaphors and things which people understand and can feel and touch and are tangible and whatever. And even, I was reading this morning about Apple, all that song and dance they made about encryption and end-to-end encryption and stuff. And then by default, they upload your data into iCloud, including SMS, iMessage and everything like that, in an unencrypted way. Left hand's not talking to the right hand here, you know. So unless we have what Bruce Schneier, who's a security expert, talks about in terms of air gaps and computers which are just never connected to the internet and all that kind of stuff, like, we're never going to be completely secure and private, but I suppose it's going to be appropriate uses of technology for different things. So, for example, hey, instead of using Facebook Messenger and having every single keystroke sent to Mark Zuckerberg's Eye of Sauron, why not use Telegram in, like, off-the-record mode so that your chat is encrypted end-to-end between you and the recipients, or CryptoCat in the browser, or whatever it is. And if something's for public consumption, then I can't see why you'd need to have huge layers of encryption behind it, unless you're trying to remain anonymous. But for things which are personal communications, I think the default should be encrypted quite heavily, because usually when you're having a private conversation with someone, you'd be quite annoyed and upset and probably hit the person around the head if they were hiding around the corner, eavesdropping and listening into everything you were saying to someone else.
Well, I do think, I mean, it's something that I almost know nothing about, except every so often I'll read something on the internet that gives me a step backwards. And it's that kind of thing that I say, there's degrees of not knowing, but, you know, the thing I remember, and I don't know how much value is in it, but there was a survey recently where they asked a whole bunch of people if they used the internet and if they used Facebook. And there were people who said they used Facebook but didn't use the internet.
Oh, that was Laura de Reynal's research at Mozilla when she went around Africa and some parts of India and Bangladesh, which was eye-opening and scary and fascinating. Mm.
And it's that kind of... We really are using stuff that we have very little. I suppose we always have. I never know how a car works. So,
and that's often the analogy that's used, and that's fair enough. But it's not really like... It's not really... I mean, this is the problem with metaphors, isn't it? Like, the metaphors break down really quickly because nothing else that we use has network effects. Like, the concept of retweeting something to thousands more people and that being retweeted and, like, ripples on a pond, I guess that's a metaphor. Mm. But it's just extremely difficult to understand. And there's, you know, public shaming and there's all this kind of stuff going on. It's not like anything else we've ever experienced as a human race.
Yeah, we need probably as much help as we can get finding a way through that, I think. Certainly.
We kind of digressed into privacy and security and stuff. We were talking about badges and technology and kind of back in the day and trying to get everyone blogging. You said that.
It's mostly understanding, and it may be, but as technology becomes easier and easier to use, people understand less and less of it. And somebody I was talking to the other day was bemoaning the fact that they were getting kids in their class who didn't know how to keyboard because they had always used tablets and things like that. And I don't know how important it is, but it certainly makes educating around it quite difficult if what you're educating is continually shifting.
Yeah, it does. And I remember when the iPad came out, Siri came out for the iPad, everyone was like, oh, that's the end of keyboard. But really, you know, there's plenty of times when it just wouldn't be appropriate to talk to your computer, even if it had perfect voice recognition.
Yeah, I think most of the time, actually, because it'd make it very embarrassing on the train. You're doing things like that, and we can't all talk to our phones as we're trying to get things done. The other thing that you talk about a lot, Doug, is productivity, which is using, I guess, the affordances of all these technologies in the best and, I guess, most balanced way possible.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering how your approach to these sorts of things has changed over the last few years.
I guess I was always looking for stuff which would make me even more productive. And I guess I've had a couple of realizations. The first, there's a wonderful, wonderful series of... It's called The Setup. It's at usesthis.com. And perhaps my favorite is the one where Clay Shirky, who is interviewed, and it was last year, back in April last year, and he talks about, basically, people are asked, what type of hardware do you use, what type of software do you use, and what would be your dream setup? And his answer to what would be your dream setup is fantastic, and he goes into other some stuff, and he says, I actually don't want a dream setup. I know people who get everything in their work environment just so, but current optimization is long-term anachronism. And I think that's just such a fantastic way of looking at, like, perpetual beta, always trying to find something better, but at the same time realizing that you have to make use of what you've got now. So that's why I used to set up things all sorts of ways and, you know, have a very custom setup. But now I try and use everything in default mode, because then I can just pick things up and go. I can use someone else's machine. If I need to do a reinstall, I haven't got to spend ages like reconfiguring it or whatever. And I'm more interested in the level of abstraction above what it is that the tool is actually doing. So I'm not interested in using Evernote or Google Keep or Simple Note. I'm interested in having notes which sync across all of my devices. I don't really care which one it is. I'd prefer it was in some kind of open format. I don't really care about using Google Docs. I'm interested in, you know, the function of it and the fact that it's easy to use and it's not locking me into anything, and it hopefully defaults towards being open source software, etc. So yeah, I guess it's all about how things connect together. And the biggest difference, I think, from now compared to 2005 is that back in 2005, 10 years ago, you had effectively the option of choosing a silo, like Microsoft, or using open source software, which would be a bit clunky and you had to kind of stitch it together a bit. Whereas now, we've got this culture of everything being free and kind of data mined and everything, which has its own problems, but everything comes with an API. So tools like Slack or IFTTT or any of these new breed of applications which hook in with everything, Instructures, Canvas is another one, means that you can get almost anything plugged into anything these days. I was reading an article on TechCrunch called, you know, they talk about full-time equivalencies, especially in higher education.
Mm.
Well, this article was talking about how actually the API is the new FTE, because if you were going to spend, give an example of someone spending like £52,000 on software as a service, all these different services they were using, MailChimp and Slack and all this kind of stuff, saying that's loads of money. But actually, if you hired somebody to do all those jobs, they, you know, you'd pay them the same amount of money and they couldn't do all that stuff.
Mm.
So I remember years ago someone saying everybody will have an algorithm on their team. And I was like, what does that even mean? That makes no sense. But that's effectively what we've got now. If you work in a very agile environment, you've got APIs effectively as part of your team because they allow you to do stuff that you wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. So this TechCrunch article, it's a bit overblown, but it's interesting in the sense of we're now like, we can supercharge business workflow education processes through APIs and openness on a level which isn't open source software.
Mm, yeah, I'm noticing at my current position that I'm working beside developers and technological people, and I don't have really anything to do with using that sort of stuff, but they are very much into making things automatic as opposed to and it sometimes seems to spend so long setting things up so that they sort of flow from one set of tools to another in a way that I don't really understand, and I think you'd be better just typing that in, but it gives them it gives them this sense of consistency, I think, mm-hmm. and that means things don't break, and eventually things become, you know, a bit of software goes onto a server somewhere, as I understand it, and it comes from GitHub in some sort of strange way and is built up, and then the tests are done, and that automatically kicks off the next stage, and automatically kicks off the next stage, which I guess is you know, using different bits of software to control other bits in a sort of API way.
Yeah, and you know, for people who are listening who don't know what an API is, application programming interface, it's the way in which you can tweet or send something to Facebook when you're in a different app. It's a way in which it interfaces, one app interfaces with another. And it's quite clever stuff. And the thing which I think it's useful for is getting rid of what some people call like bullshit jobs or just boring, repetitive kind of things where really this kind of stuff shouldn't be done by humans. It should be done by machines. And if we can do that, yes, in the short term, it could lead to less jobs, but hopefully it would free up the human race to be more creative. And there's you know, things on the horizon like a universal basic income, which might stop us from eating each other. So yeah, I think I'm quite optimistic about all this stuff.
Hmm. I certainly like that universal the sort of baseline income for everybody. Mm. Sounds like a great idea. You use the robots too. I mean, that was always a sci-fi dream. The robots will free us up to have more fun time.
One of the things I'm in a very fortunate position where I can kind of design my lifestyle. I've been a a wage slave for years and years and years. And I'm now really trying to think. I mean, when I was reaching out to people and saying, you know, should I become a consultant? Should I do this, like that? You know, and just reaching out to people who I really respected. Some of those people pointed out to me that they only work 4 days a week, for example, and they have a day to themselves during the week, which is just for themselves, for their own projects, not income generating. One day it might be cleaning out the garage. The next day it might be doing a course. Another day they could be doing their expenses. It's basically self-directed stuff, which doesn't impinge on their family time at the weekend. And so that's what I'm trying to design into my life at the moment, because otherwise you just do either, well, you just end up doing what either your clients or your boss tell you that you need to do, which I think is a shame. Or you do it on your own time, which, you know, you and I, John, have spent hours and hours and hours, which must count up to days and weeks, doing in our own time in the evening up until the wee hours, trying to figure out how bits of technology work. And I guess I just want to be more sustainable in my old age.
Yeah, it sounds like a really, I mean, I think a 4 day week is a delightful thing. It's a wee bit like, and I know some schools here have tried out this idea of Google 20% time. And I think quite often it's more like 10% time. So we have an afternoon in a primary school where children can follow, their own interests. And I guess it's kind of like that. And the idea would be if you're working for somebody that they get payback because you learn, you become more creative, and lots of interesting things come from serendipity, I guess. And
there's a couple of questions actually on Twitter which I'd like to answer. So Mariana Funes says, tell us about the rationale for your Black Ops digital detox. Does it increase your productivity? And Ian Guest has asked, is agility possible in environments which are quite constrained and conservative, for example, education? So I'll take the one from Mariana first because it's possibly the easiest. The reason I've done the digital detox thing, I did the first one was in 2007 and I've done it a bit longer for the last 5 years. Stephen Downs did one, and then the kind of proximate cause was Dana Boyd. She goes completely off grid, goes like Easter Island and stuff for however long. And just, they obviously, even though I don't know them like personally face to face, they obviously came back more recharged, full of energy, etc. And so I just tried it because I used to think that seasonal affective disorder was just a thing that people used to make up to hide their weakness.
I thought you were a sufferer.
I am. Yeah. I am. So I realise I get very grumpy. So I live in the north of England, not too far south of where you live, actually, John. Although we're you're across the border. And what I found was I was getting grumpy, and my parents actually said, "There's this light therapy you can get." And I was like, oh, bollocks, whatever. But they bought me one and just said, look, try it, half an hour a day. What can possibly go wrong as you're working? And it made such a difference. And I was like, oh, my goodness, this is fantastic. So I realized that actually I needed to do something to help myself. One of the reasons I found teaching so difficult, I think, and unsustainable in the longer term, one was, without it being a humble brag, going into senior management and skipping middle management and going into before I was ready. That was not a good thing. But the other thing was, I find this time of year really tough. The change between seasons, between summer and autumn, and the lights decreasing and all that kind of stuff. And so just kind of looking after yourself. And so I usually do the digital detox, hiatus, Belshaw Black Ops, as Paul Lewis, who now works at Google, grundly named it. I usually do it November, December time, but for lots of reasons, I decided this summer I wanted to spend some time more away from digital stuff, more time with my family, that kind of stuff. And so I'm going to do August and December. And what I find, actually, is I stop thinking in 140 character tweets.
Yeah.
Which sounds ridiculous. I do, and I start thinking longer thoughts, and I can actually focus and read longer form stuff, and I'm just a more chilled out, less stressed version of me, which is quite nice.
So that's quite interesting, because a couple of weeks ago I had Kenny Piper, an English teacher in Scotland, on talking, and one of the things he did over the summer was try and read War and Peace because he felt that reading online had eroded his, attention span to text. And do you feel you get it back?
Mm, yes, I do. It takes quite a while. So I was talking to Di on the Tide podcast about this, the one that went out yesterday. It's episode 21 called Back in Black. And I was saying how it sounds ridiculous for a 34-year-old man to say, I had to relearn how to be by myself in public without looking at a smartphone screen. You know, like standing in the post office queue without getting my phone out or whatever. But it's true. Like, we've just engineered this situation where it's possible to be looking at a screen almost all of the time. And never being alone because you take your network with you. And so you just never think. You're on the toilet with your phone. You're in bed with your phone. You're in the queue with your phone. Like, it's just everywhere. And so it was a bit of a struggle to get back into reading longer form stuff. I always read like fiction before I go to bed, but reading longer form non-fiction, I actually got round to reading all the stuff I'd saved to pocket and things, and just spending some time and actually training myself, getting halfway through an article, realizing that I'm enjoying it, but actually I want to stop reading it, and then going back and saying, no, you can finish this. Like, it's ridiculous. Like, I've written a doctoral thesis, yet I still can't.
Yeah, the end of a long paragraph. I think that's really interesting. I'll just say, hi, Mariana. I think that Doug, there's a lot of things that Mariana's interested in around these things. She runs a quite interesting Twitter stream called... Well, it's called the Daily Live Times, at Live Times, which is the Daily Stillness, which kind of tweets every day some sort of suggestion about finding some sort of quiet in the hubbub of a digital environment. So that's worth checking out if you're interested in this stuff, folks.
Wonderful. I'm going to have a look at that. I already follow Mariana, but I'll have a look at that. Okay, and Ian's question, is agility possible in environments which are quite constrained and conservative, i.e. education? Don't ever think. So a wonderful book that I recommend everyone who works in an organization should read is the executive edition of Gareth Morgan's Images of Education. So it first came out in the 1980s. The executive edition came out in the 1990s. You can get on Amazon secondhand and whatever. But what it does is, each chapter, it takes the organization and uses a metaphor to describe it. So the organization is a psychic prison. The organization is a machine. And what it allows you to do is to realize that every time the person in charge of the organization describes the organization, they will always use language which describes it in some kind of metaphorical terms. So it's using that with the person who is in charge of the organization to get the change that you want to see. So if they see the organization as a well-oiled machine, or it should be like that, then you use that kind of language when you're talking to them, etc. So I'd highly recommend that. But even if you can't get hold of that, then what I would say to your particular point about being more agile, it depends what you mean by agile. If you mean about like having scrum masters and having daily stand-ups and stuff, then probably not. But then I've just been working in an organization where I've literally said, okay, well, can you make a decision without having a face-to-face meeting? And they kind of looked at me, and I was like, well, if you can't, then you need some kind of tool that has a process built into it. So there's a tool called Trello, which is free to use, and, you know, it's like a freemium model. And you use a Kanban approach, which is literally a list of to-do, doing, and done. So you imagine putting those kind of swim lanes putting those kind of lists on the wall in terms of post-it notes, to-do, doing, and done. And then you move post-it notes between it, if that was a wall, but it just happens to be a digital place where you can upload files and you can move things about and stuff. And I've actually created some badges for this, which ties us back to the start of the conversation quite nicely. So if you search for Kanban, which is Kanban, Kanban, badge, Doug Belshaw, whatever, you'll find those. And what I've tried to do is to scaffold people in thinking about how to set up Trello or any tool like it so that you can work with other people and you can have a more agile approach, even though it's not strict agile development methodology. So it's all about kind of baby steps and responding to problems or perceived problems.
Interestingly, I mean, just more to sort of kick the badge tires, I had a wee shot with Trello when you vlogged about that, and it turned out that, because usually I'm fairly allergic to productivity tools, they don't really seem to work for me, but I've been using it steadily to organise this the radio shows, and it's just great. It's also a really nicely designed bit of web software, I think.
It is really good, and it's one of those, like a sandbox tool, I would say, John, like a one where, because you can do so many different things, like Evernote or Slack as well, because you can do so many different things with it, sometimes you need some kind of scaffolding, someone to show you, hey, why don't you set up like this? And I think the badge approach of like having a, what was it, Kanban 101, an advanced Kanban, means that you go and set it up this way. It's not like, oh yeah, I'll put that on my to-do list. You go and set it up this way to get the badge, then you realize, oh, I can play about this, I can tinker and do whatever. And I really like it, and I use it personally. I use it professionally in my consultancy and stuff. And it fills the need right now. I think you can overuse any kind of tool, but what I do like is I kind of have different recipes on IFTTT that trigger things, and it feeds into Slack and hypothesis RSS feed and all kinds of stuff.
But as I say, for people who are sort of disorganized and rely on, you know, piles of text files all scattered over the place, I was surprised that, yeah, it just didn't take me long. And I really thought I was just trying it out to see how the badge process worked, because I hadn't done that for a wee while. And now finding it really, really useful. So thank you for that. That was a great one. And I think if there are unproductive people like myself out there, this is a good one for the wee bit of thing you need to get your productivity or organisation together.
John, if you're unproductive, I'd hate to see what a productive person looks like.
Well, I think they're ones who actually have a plan and achieve it rather than play on the internet all day long. And you know,
you'd be surprised. Yeah, we're all just messing about and winging it and making it up as we go along.
Yeah. Anyway, we've now run to about an hour, Doug. Kept you from whatever bake-off, I believe.
thank you for that. Yeah.
some people, you know, find it difficult to come on the Wednesday when that's on.
I just sit and take the mick out of it while my wife watches it in earnest.
But it's been just lovely talking to you. I don't know if there's anything you want to throw in as a roundup, or we did circle back quite nicely, I think.
Oh, I wanted to talk about. Oh, we're not going to have time now, but I wanted to talk about the technology which underpins Bitcoin, which, as you know, is the blockchain, and some stuff which I've been thinking about at the moment. So this guy called Vinay Gupta, who I think you all have heard some of his stuff and listened to his podcast before, and he's not quite on the level of being a good mate, but he's certainly an acquaintance and someone who I go and have dinner with sometimes. And he has been doing some work with Ethereum, which is like crypto fuel based on like blockchain technology. So if you don't know what I'm talking about and you're listening to this podcast, go and just have a look at ethereum.org, which is spelled as you'd think it would be spelled. And just think about what's possible. There's an article in The Guardian today. Let's see if I can dig this out, where Imogen Heap is going to be experimenting with smart contracts based on Ethereum. So very quickly, what this means is somebody goes to a website, buys an album, there's a public ledger of this having happened, and then the smart contract is like an if that then this. So all the people who were involved with the album, from, you know, doing the design, the engineering, everything like this, everyone gets paid immediately, because all of it is algorithmically programmed in this smart contract. And I think this is another example of how technology can do what would previously be a boring human job. And so I'm really excited about this because a few months ago I wrote a blog post about how you could use badges with a blockchain, which again I will come up with the link to put in the show notes.
That would be great. Yeah, I actually read the article about Imogen Heap on I think it was the Observer at the weekend, and which is probably why it turned up on the Guardian website, just to confuse us. But yeah, it looked like really interesting, although it is something I have no knowledge about at all. But fascinating stuff, because it just seemed to solve all these problems about for artists getting paid and the likes, the bad things seem to be happening to these people.
It needs people like you, yeah. John, just figuring stuff out, and being able to describe it in metaphors, in homely ways, and in ways which don't sound too scary, so people can pick it up and start using it and figuring out how it can be useful for education. I've tried, in that article, which I've linked to, some of the images don't seem to be loading, but basically I tried to explain how you could do open badges with a blockchain, so you can have trusted digital credentials in a very easy, very distributed, scalable way. So, anyway, on that bombshell, we should probably finish.
Okay, yeah, I've got a great set of tabs open here, which I will dump in as show notes to the blog. The post, it should be up in a couple of days on edutalk.cc. Doug, you are on Twitter DAJ Belshaw.
That's right.
And DougBelshaw.com for the blog. And I guess there's links from DougBelshaw.com to, well, it's more like a kickoff page to your blog, yeah. To Tide, to the newsletter. And so I certainly get good value out of all these things. So, great stuff, and I'll pile these into the show notes for everybody to listen to. So thank you very much for talking to us. If folk want to have them listen, they'll pop the archive up soon. Thanks to the folk who did listen and tweeted in, Ian and Marianne, good to hear from you, and I'll just hang this up now.
Thanks very much, John. Bye bye.
Cheers.